And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2025, and this is the final stream for tonight. And I am now here with Soccer City. I'm aware that the caption is not up on screen, but I'll be dealing with that shortly. Soccer City, can you please introduce yourself to the audience?
Thanks. Thanks for having me. So I'm a middle-aged father who has been observing the dissident movement. You know, might have been used to be called the alt-right, might have been, there's various labels. But I'm reluctant to really get labeled and pigeonholed as something. So I'm thinking of myself as like a political dissident to an elite that's doing a bad job in a system that sucks in a country that's going broke, which is Canada. And so I attended university when I was in my 20s, like we were all told to, I think yourself included. It was considered like a mark of success to get entry. And then it was a bit difficult to get into university. And then they suddenly let everyone in, and it became like an industry. So when I got in, it was this is in like the early 2000s. When I got in, it was, you know, difficult. The parents are proud and all the things that you'd expect. And by the time I got out some years later, it was like, this degree might not get me a job, and I've got some student debt. And, you know, as a kind of naive person, you see more for the reality of the world, and you're kind of out there. Fortunately, I worked in the trades in the summer, so I basically have a trade in building construction and that sort of thing. So fast forward 20 years and passing from somebody that thought, like, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to win the election because she was good on that rascal Putin. And, you know, being like, I had no problem really with the system, though I could see there were problems in the future if things weren't addressed. And so I'm with the partner that I met when I first attended university. So that's a good place to meet partners, I guess, anecdotally. And we've had children. So I have toddlers now. And rather than really pursuing my degree, I was working in various like building trades, trade stuff, construction drilling, construction management. And as a father, with a young family, and my youngest, of course, has diagnosed moderate to severe autism. So he's a bit of a handful in the sense that we do our best to get him his best possible health outcome. And, you know, here's your Christmas miracle. It happened. They didn't know if he would ever be verbal, and he's fully conversational. He's got deep level, like emotional understanding of things. So he's really cognitively come along, but to get to that result, my partner couldn't work, and I could only work sort of sporadically. So she, a few years ago, we decided like, you should return to university, return to school. She actually got into some other sort of things first, but then we settled on like, just go to university. We loved it. We met there. It's kind of the place to be. You know, it's a good life. Academia is beautiful.
So before we get to that, I should have said this at the start, that you're going to be talking about a possible option for a lot of people in dissident politics, and people of our sort of age and older and younger people, but people who are beyond their early 20s, late teens, when people usually go to university. So we are going to talk about the benefits and joys of being a mature student in this day and age as a dissident. And we'll just leave it at that for now. And so you were in a predicament where you needed to be, I'll outline that again in a bit more detail, just for the sake of setting the scene. Can you hear me?
I can, yeah.
Yeah. Can you outline the situation that you were in a bit more detail, just for the sake of setting the scene before we
get... Sorry, beg your pardon. I thought you said that you would do it. Okay, so... Oh, no. Yes. So there's my personal need to be with family for sort of a bit of an out of the box reason, though it's not uncommon to have, when you look at the statistics in our current world, the amount of people that have some sort of mental permanent or temporary mental disorder, disability, okay, it's extraordinarily high. In Canada, the statistics are that 50% of sort of, young people, teens, early 20s, whatever, 50% will experience some sort of mental disability that's like temporary, and long-term is like 20%. And so I'll be focusing a bit on ADD, which I was diagnosed with this, and my partner was as well. And my son has autism. So this is a specific message to people, of which there are millions, that have sort of challenges to overcome. And a little bit of a study in the benefits and things that are available going into university, because people will think of it as you're going to incur more debt. And also you had mentioned, for younger people, but yeah. I disagree with that assertion. Now I'm getting a second degree. So I'm,
Yeah, of course people can go to university at any age, once they're adulthood, but this specifically is about doing it older than most people would think of doing it. So you were in this situation where you needed money to sustain yourself and your family.
Time.
And time at home. So at some point your wife thought, why not go back to university? So take it from there.
Yeah, so she went first. And you don't know, because you see all of the different loan amounts, and the system is really complicated. And I've been looking into that in the Canadian context, okay, of the system of loans, bursaries, scholarships, all the different financing that's available. Do you do that through the government? Do you do that through the bank? What's the best way to do this if you're going to do it? And it varies from country to country, but I can say after researching it that within the English-speaking world, it's quite similar. And as you might expect, like the Central European countries, maybe Scandinavia, they're pretty similar. Okay, so they usually have a way to finance tuition costs, and then also to pay for your life as you're attending university, which is the bigger cost. Like there's this fallacy out there that, oh, tuitions are going up. I went to university in one of the most expensive places in Canada, and tuition was a breeze. It was the cost of living while away at school. So I was concerned about this. And when she finally got her various student loan allotments of in Canada, they're called dependents, which mean children. Okay. You get all these sort of different, a breakdown, and that's not necessarily transparent to people. The system itself keeps that a little bit hidden, and I suspect that it's because they don't really want you to know that this is kind of like what's available to you, right? And so it's only until you get basically like right before you are attending your first day in class, you get your disbursement. And I was like, well, that's good, as a as a parent that herself, she has diagnosed ADHD. Okay. So, which is interesting because if you're talking to someone, she's very intelligent, she has ADHD, and she's the kind of person that you'll be talking to while she's doing something else. Okay. So if she would be on a laptop right now doing something unrelated and occasionally looking up to you, and then you test her, right? Like, or have you been listening? And she's caught it all.
Right.
So,
right.
So, yeah. And you know, these are impediments to learning, and that's why they increase your amounts. But you know, you get a small bursary for that. You get some for a child. And in our case, we had a disabled child, which I think it's not that much that you get more for that. But what you're doing at this point is you're kind of stacking all of the incremental little bonuses, scholarships, bursaries, help you can get from like a corporation. Okay. There's corporations love to give out bursaries and scholarships, foundations and all this. And in the aggregate, when you look at all the help that you can get, okay, because if you roughly break it down, there's your student, your loan, which is repayable, and then there are the bursaries, the free money component, if you want to think of it that way. And so I kept working. I was doing construction management, which was like a really time-consuming job, and she was able to be with our children. We had a second child. And I was just looking at it, and I was like, This is financially sensible. And to give to put a number on it, in Canada, her disbursement every 4 months, okay, and she goes three semesters a year, is $15,000 Canadian approximately. And about half of that is loan that will need to be repaid at someday, okay? Which isn't bad if you have to focus on your family and you want time and a lower stress. Like, you can try to do this through the rat race in a system of daycare and going to your, you know, probably corporate job of some kind, you know, especially for women. You can try to grind it out, and you'll lose both battles. You'll still be going into debt because you'll have to pay daycare costs. You'll be up at 5 a.m. running your kid off to a daycare before you go to your own job. You'll lose all kinds of time from your employment as well. And this is a big concern in Canada right now. And I hear this all the time because we're networked with other mothers. Your kid, and especially if you have more than one kid, you can double these numbers. Your kid's going to be sick, like needs care for, especially over the winter months, for like a week, a month. We were sick all the time over the winters. It's just, you know, in the bounce back from COVID, just people are saying the herd is unhealthy. Okay. And children are a magnet for germs, you know, disease. Like, we had the joy of like hand, foot and mouth disease, which is this disease I'd not heard of, but your child's gums bleed when you brush them. If you can imagine how fun that would be. And so, so when you just look at it, how it actually breaks down, then you can also add that Canadians are, I think, the most taxed people in the world. So yeah, I make, you know, say I make $85,000 a year. That means, you know, in Canada, that means like what, 45. You got to look at your nominal tax rate. There's all these factors. So after a couple of years of doing that, I just looked at her and I was like, is it really worth me working this job where I'm missing out on family stuff? I'm unable to try to get my son to where he needs to be for a health outcome. You know, my other son, he's a little tank, you know, he barely needs me, but you still want to be a father for your kid. And so I returned myself to school. And basically, if you stack up all of the advantages that you get, okay, so if you have dependents that are disabled, you're getting bursaries and scholarships and this sort of thing, you're almost in a situation where you're living in like, I don't want to say a communist country, but like, let's just, like, everyone knows in Canada that, and I talk to friends about this, that they're working 40, 60 hours a week, you know, like they're grinding it out, and they just don't seem to really be getting ahead. So you can try to bulldog it through this you know, just on like, no, I'm doing this on work ethic, and I've done it for decades. You know, I've worked in heavy trades, dangerous jobs, helicopters, bears, workplace fatalities, blood, guts, nasty stuff. And so knowing this, that like as our country, and this is the same across the West, kind of dwindles from a place that rewards just grinding it out and hard work into one that rewards other pursuits. Okay. I just noticed that financially, just what we were doing just made sense. And yes, you were incurring debt. You're incurring debt. And I'll put a number on it. Like, let's say per year, you're going $20,000 in debt. But is that worth the price to you to be getting an education in academia, which is a good, interesting life, to be able to look after your children? And also, like in Canada, you get tuition credits. So as you are paying your tuition, they're giving you future tax credits, which are almost offsetting that $20,000 number anyways. So if you really look at it and then you live it, because I could explain this to people and I could pull up like charts or whatever and numbers, but it's not until you're in it, living it. And I'm in like entering my second year of doing this now, where I'm like, this financially makes sense. Now there are a whole other aspect, a bunch of aspects that I haven't touched on about this. Basically, your income is going down as you're a student. It's almost zero. So, but as a parent, you're getting a Canada child benefit. I think you get that in the UK and other countries too. I know Canada, having researched this, has one of the most generous benefit systems for children. The States has the worst, as you might expect. But if you look at what you can bring in for income, and so in Canada, the number that we get for a number is about $1,900 a month. So if you're adding that to what you're getting in for your university tuition amounts and everything, you're offsetting it by tax balances. And then you're looking at the benefits that you can get for having a low income, okay? But when they factor your income, they don't count like student income to that. Okay, it's considered like a different kind of income. It's not like taxable really. It's so when you like your earned income, I think it's called. And this, again, I've looked into this at least in some part to other countries, and it seems to be the case either in a very similar way or in some way that another country does it by they'll maybe like just lower your tax rate or give you a grant here. There's different ways that different countries incentivize returning to school. Now, if you're a young person and you're just purely going to school and you're trying to get through university in 4 years and you think there's a career on the other side of it and whatnot, that's one situation. But if you're a parent and you're able to get child benefits from the state, and this is where like it becomes like an our people thing, because I think that there's a big portion of middle-aged parents, you know, white or native Canadians, old stock Canadians, Americans, however you want to think of it, that feel sort of disenfranchised, feel like, you know, university not the place for them, and they need to grind it out at their job, and they go corporate, right? And they're my taxes, and they're looking for all their tax advantages, and so it gets quite stressful too, right? On people trying to grind it through the system. And I know this because I talk to people in my age cohort that are just, you know, they're not able to spend time with their children. They're fighting against the taxes. They're fighting, and it seems to me like rather than taking what is like a workable, practical solution to a problem, which is, you know, just return to school, get a higher level of education, which, by the way, the metrics on achieving a higher level of education are you're going to have like a longer life expectancy, a higher income, better life satisfaction. There's a big body of research on people that go to school, higher achievement is kind of like kind of a better life, right? So, you know, if you're just grinding it away as a parent, or even if you're not a parent, but you have a partner and maybe you guys want to take off some time, maybe it's stressful. Maybe you have a lot of workplace anxiety. I don't think that the way through that is always to just grit your teeth, take the blood and pain and just, you know, go through this painful 9-to-5 cycle. Okay. Think outside of the box and approach it from a position of trying to maximize all of the advantages while minimizing all of the disadvantages. The advantages are you're considered low income for the purpose of any kind of benefits that society has, from tax rate to being able to go to like a food bank or something like that, which if you're a parent, there's no shame in that, by the way. and then you add to the fact that we're looking at what's going to be at the very least like an economic recession, if we're not already in it. People in the dissident right and, people that are more cynical or that question things more think that Canada is in a recession. They think that there's a depression coming. Okay. So then like I could talk about the issues of like what the employment market is actually like, as I've observed it, which is that you're competing increasingly with people that have, are more incentivized to come and earn money, like say in Canada, if they come from India, which is a poorer country, and then they can send their remittances home. People know what I'm talking about, right? So it's not a nice employment situation in Canada or anywhere in the West. Now the States might actually have the best one in this regard, because their economy, from what I can gather, is actually doing well. But there's a mentality here, and I think it's not particular to like white people, but maybe it's more so for us, where we just view like to take any sort of shortcut exception, to take advantage of the state, to take advantage of like a corporation, to take advantage of a food bank or something like that, as to be like less than honorable. So for me, I'd say, yeah, like that might be true. But if you have children, and if you have disabled children, and if you yourself have some disability, and here we could talk about like, you know, these are what are disabilities now, like that are official disabilities that you can get some benefit for. Okay. And these are not uncommon. Depression, ADHD, anxiety. It's a big list. And I think that genuinely, it wouldn't be unusual to be depressed in an economic depression in a world where we have wars breaking out all over. Okay. So if you need to go to a doctor, and if your mind can't focus because you're experiencing a mental illness, and from that you get some benefit from school, yeah, do it. You don't need to be the last doughboy that goes over the top in a failed charge. Okay. And
and the other thing is just that people have already contributed so much to society, so they might as well get something back.
Yeah. I think that's
the long and the short of it.
Yeah, I mean, like I've worked in trades for over 20 years, and other jobs too. I've had corporate and white collar jobs. I've grounded out. I've seen like where my taxes go. I've seen that I'm not being like rewarded fairly. And another aspect would be, so this is important. I was speaking about stacking advantages. Okay, so one advantage, and so you don't actually get like that much for being for having a disability like ADHD, depression, anxiety, or worse, like a major physical disability, but it's like a fair shake. You get a few thousand dollars more per semester in Canada. They'll give you a laptop worth $2,500. I mean, that varies from province to province, territory to province, whatever, but they're going to give you stuff to help you through, because we do at the end of the day have a compassionate, you know, post-European Christian culture, you know. There's help available, but what I found that the most helpful thing that was received is, and I looked into this, and I think this is true for the Anglosphere, so Australia, other countries. It might not be universally true, and do look into it. Don't take my word. But you can be considered a full-time student on two courses per semester. And so this is what I'm talking about with time. So as a full-time student on two courses, and the typical amount of courses that people take are four. Okay, that's what I got my first degree. I did four and sometimes five. At the end, I did, I think, 2 5s to just get through it and go face the workforce. That was fun. So to be able to qualify for your full loan and tuition and bursary amounts on two courses, that makes it for you to be able to be with your family full time. You can work almost full time and take two courses. I wouldn't say you could be a family man of two kids and work and go to school on two courses, though you probably could if you had to. But to be able to be a full time student on two courses will mean two things. You have a lot more time. Secondly, your grades are just going to be higher, almost definitionally, if you have more time to work on your schooling. You can apply yourself more. And so I found that my partner's like a sniper. She's getting like A's, A pluses. I can't remember if she actually did get 100% in a university course, or like she gets like 95, like her marks are incredible, right? When you do that, and I did the same, and like for my first kick at the can at university, I was there to meet girls' party, and just because I was told to go to university. So my grades were like, you know, it's probably a B student, which is bad. And you're not going to go anywhere as a B student because you're just graduating a giant blob of people that have B grades. But if you start to get really high grades, you get scholarships. So I don't, my year this year, I'm not even basically paying. It's like I said in an article that I wrote that it was a full ride scholarship. That was untrue. It just covered like 95% of my tuition costs. Okay. It was maybe a bit of a flirting. And by the way, I'm talking about a Substack article now called Riding Out the Storm in the Schoolhouse, which I wrote a few months ago. Now, so if you start to reach high levels of academic marks, accomplishment, they'll start to like invite you into like societies. They'll start to give you scholarships. You know, you kind of get the more of the feeling that you thought you should have had the first time around. So there's a huge advantage to having this time. And as I said, and this is important. So if anyone is like Osoker City, there's an expression we use in Canada, but I won't say it on the show. I'll try to run it clean, but it has to do with dogs and love. You're seen as a bit of like a less of a person if you're not working. You can, like, if that's a problem for you, you can be a full-time student on two courses if you have a disability. If not, the number is three. Okay, so you can still get good grades on three courses, and you can still work probably full-time. I wouldn't say you can be a family member too, but I mean you could. But repeating myself here.
So just to be clear. Let's say three courses, because most people don't have a disability, unless they can persuade the authorities that they have a disability.
It's not difficult. The diagnostic criteria are incredibly broad for something like ADHD. And I mean, who isn't depressed? Like, your doctor would be kind of a...
Who isn't autistic nowadays? Apparently we all are.
The numbers are shocking. I don't have them right in front of me, but it's like I've seen numbers that like one in like, I think it was like one in 12 or one in 20 kids born now have that diagnosis.
Oh, so. Yeah. But I mean, even like, just to be on the spectrum, like Asperger's, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like it's difficult to persuade the authorities today that you're on that spectrum.
You can do it on a phone call. Yeah, you can do it with a phone call to. Because the healthcare system is overburdened, they've kind of privatized some aspects. So you can get a diagnosis from a nurse practitioner or maybe a doctor on a phone call from a private corporation for a few hundred dollars. You honestly have a series of meetings on a phone with them and talk. That's how I got mine. I was diagnosed with ADHD, and look, I just looked at the diagnostic criteria, and they were like, you know, when you're in an elevator, are you just hammering that button? Like you can't wait. Do you talk over people all the time? I think I just did a few seconds ago. Like,
I can vouch for that. I don't know if you did or not, but anyway, so that's an important point to make. So most people, let's just assume most people aren't going to go that route. They don't have a disability, and that's that. So 3 courses in order to be a full-time student and get the various bursaries that you're talking about. What does 3 courses mean in terms of hours per week? I know it's going to differ from one subject to another, but you know,
this is where as being returning to school as a person in their 40s, okay, versus going there when you're, I was in college when I was 19, 20, and then transferred to a university. You just have a completely different mentality. Like my mentality when I was young was to do the bare minimum to get through, because the people said C's get degrees. And honestly, probably D's get degrees. I don't know. And so when you return to it as a more diligent, dutiful, maybe world-weary adult and somebody that wants to accomplish, you're going to use the tricks that you used in your working life, and you're going to find academia. And I'm in political science, arts, you know, I'm not talking about engineering, to be clear, but even in engineering, if you had come, and I have friends that have gone, like I know a doctor that was a paramedic in his 40s, and he decided to go to med school, and he got his, you know, he's now like a 50-year-old doctor. I know there are success stories, if you look for them, all over the place, of people that went from a career and the grind to return to school, found it easy, were at the top of the class, did really well, got the scholarships. And so this isn't uncommon. Like this isn't, these aren't even rare exceptions. Usually people that are mature return to school and they do extremely well. And like, I think I wrote this in my essay. I was like in class, you're just mogging it. It's like you and your professor are having a conversation and there's some kids, you know, in the room. And honestly, like no disrespect to younger students. I've been really impressed actually, which might surprise some people, at the quality of some of the young minds that I've gone to school with. It's not how you might think. We can get into that in sort of the third.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to nail this point about how many hours per week are we talking about in order to be considered a full-time student?
So this is a bit difficult because the school university has changed a lot since COVID. But certainly have a lot of your courses you're going to be able to take fully online. Now, an online course will constitute your reading material and online lectures. For an online lecture, especially if you're gifted with ADHD, you don't want to listen to all that. So you can put it on 1.5 speed I'm addicted to earbuds, so that's kind of why I'm like a dissident. I have the time to listen to millennial and others. Like I'm probably going to get a brain tumor from having MP3 Bluetooth earbuds in all day. So you'll be driving and like instead of the radio, you're listening to your lectures on like 1.5 times speed. Okay. So there's a certain amount of like tech savvy and like cheats. And these are good faith cheats. Like this isn't like a cheat, like getting an exam's answer. This is just like being smart about your studies. So you can do cram sessions. You don't even have to attend the actual campus. Okay. So you're saving in your commute time there, But the to put a number on it, like the amount of hours per week per class might be, should on paper be like four, maybe, we'll say, because there's also a reading break in there, so that changes the average. And this is part of my, like, look at it like from a have a positive point of view about this. You know, if you're like, yeah, there is a reading break where you, or that, you know, you're not expected to go to class. So there's like, I'm going to say it's 5 hours a week per class. Okay. So that's 15 hours a week. Like, can you work 15 hours a week? And you can, so you can also, you can do this while you're working. Like, I worked construction for years. You know, I was down there with a jackhammer or whatever. I remember in one specific case, I had to jackhammer out a whole slab of a floor and do all this work and then frame something. And like in my previous life, I wouldn't have really enjoyed this. Maybe I could listen to some radio, listen to some old AM rock music, which is what construction workers still listen to, and if it's not rap. But instead I was listening to earbuds, and I was listening to, like, you know, high philosophical, you know, YouTubers. And I was like, this is enjoyable.
While using a jackhammer.
Yeah, because a sound muting earbuds while using a jackhammer are actually sound protection. You could put hearing protection over that as well. And they make hearing protection that is, you know, a Bluetooth headset that's also CSA, Canada Standards Association or whatever, hearing protection. So, like, your boss can't even give you shit about this. Not that he would. So you can make time. So I'm saying it's like 15 hours. Now, around the exams, you might want to cram. But there's also the case where I've done this, where I've basically not attended or listened to a class, and then like 2 days before an exam say, and I did this for my political science class, I basically just read the textbook because I was like, I'm going to come into this. And again, this is where being a mature student has a huge advantage. I've heard this before. You know, I'm doing like a review on Elite. I just had to give this a shout out. I'm reviewing this book right now. That's Academic Agents, Applied Elite Theory, right? This is in your textbook, by the way. I thought it might not be because it's considered like too fascisty or something, but no, elite theory is like one of the major political theories that's in the opening blurb of every textbook, and then they just ignore it for 500 pages. But you're coming into this, a lot of these, with a lot of knowledge. So you can speed read through a textbook a lot more quickly. And also with a computer, like, screenshot stuff, you know, hit your F12 button, screenshot stuff. And also, oh, another thing is if you're doing, so again, like you can make the academic experience your own as a single man going into it, returning at middle age or any age. Like this can work for all kinds of people. But if you're doing this with your partner, your wife, your significant other, you're going to be studying with someone that's also studying, and you're going to be talking about what you were studying instead of when you were younger, you're talking about beer or hockey or, you know, where the chicks are or whatever it is. You're focused now. You're like, so I'm walking around the house while I'm, you know, holding my children and, you know, being a parenting, raising kids, as they used to call it. And I'm having like deep discussions about like indigenous health or something like that with my partner. And that helps to reinforce everything you've learned. Now, if you're both political dissidents and you are talking about, you know, politics, philosophy, sciences, social sciences, actual science, like I took a course in nutritional health, immensely beneficial. We took it together. So we were talking about like, oh, potassium, vitamin K all day. So it was it was reinforcing while I was parenting. So, you know, in theory, you're spending 15 hours, maybe a week working at your academic job, but really it can just flow into your life. That's doing it right. When it's just flowing into your life, it feels pretty painless. Obviously, there's some higher stress around exam time and writing papers. And I've written papers where the entire family has a flu in the deep winter. And it's like, it was the worst paper I ever wrote. The only paper I got I think I got a C minus on it. And because I was just like, this is going in. I was like, I can't do this. I'm dying. But everything else I've done has been really like, you know, I've gotten the grades. My average is like, it's over A. It's, you know, it's like my partner and I, we get grades that are good enough to, if we also had like the volunteer experience and other things, to get into like an Ivy League or a top university. So this is all achievable. And also you can do this while still being like a political dissident that is listening to, you know, do, and like, honestly, I spend much more time on like YouTube or, you know, social media than I do at my studies. Okay. So I'm raising children, one of them who is disabled, without much help from anybody, because as an older parent, your parents are too old to help, you know, like in, you know, an 80-year-old's not much good to you. It's kind of more harm than good. You know, you got to drive over to grandpa's place. And like, so as a young parent, like you're still in an age cohort that's having children. As an older parent, like you're just like we're in this, it's just us. We're basically alone here. And
So, yeah, the point was that you're able to do all of this along with the, you're able to look after two kids, one of them with autism, and do this full time, well, yeah, 15 hours a week, three courses, and it flows into your life, as you said. And it's easier than when you were 20. That was a question that I was going to ask, you know, being a student at 40 versus at 20. I think you've covered that. There are a few questions that I want to put to you.
It's fundamentally different, I would say. It's fundamentally different. Just there's something about, like, just to put in a plug for older guys, you know, in the Second World War, they did some research on survival rates of men who'd gone into the water after their ships had sunk. And they just found like it was actually the older guys that were living, because they had more of a mental, this was their conclusion, that they had more of like a mental ability to realize that they could get through things. So it was objective data showing that, like, more resilience. Yeah. You are such a different person at middle age that it bears out in statistics, regardless of all other factors.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing, because a lot of people assume that, well, as you get older, it gets harder to learn, absorb information, and so on. And I'm sure I wouldn't be surprised if that's true after the age of, let's say, 50. But it seems that when you're in your 40s, there's still plenty of, what's the word, neuroplasticity, and they're still very easy to learn. And actually, in some ways, easier than when you were 20, because you've got self-discipline. And you've got all the techniques that you've learned through, focus and marshalling information and so forth, the techniques that you've learned during your life. So this is something that I think people should consider doing. And that's why I invited you on to speak about it, because I think it seems very interesting and a way of life for some people, a potential way of life for some people. Now, again, I'm not saying that you should cheat the system. I'm not saying that you should lie or anything like that. I'm just saying it sounds like a viable, what Soccer City is recommending.
Two points. The cheat is that you're older and wiser and that you're a dissident, because we are much closer to the truth in our understanding of the way the world works than a young person. So, you know, there are all the reasons that you provided, but also there's a political reason why you're going to be a better student. Okay. Now, of course, you're entering, like, and maybe we can talk about this in the remaining time. You're entering a system which is a universally leftist system. Like even Christian universities and colleges, I think the number is like universities, colleges are considered like 95% left of center, and the 5% are like Christian. But I would suspect that even if you actually attended classes there, they're probably talking about diversity, equity, inclusion, colonialism, and all these other things. And by the way, on that note, like, there is a certain, you know, like those of us who've been like permanently online since, like, you know, 2016 or whatever, and just looking at, like, oh my, like, look at this wild truth that's being revealed to us. about how the way the world really works and all these truths or things that we think are truths, right? And it's just mind-blowing. And, you know, you could spend 10 years doing this like I did and just be like, ah, wow, nothing is as I thought. It's actually quite different. And it's a lot more maybe hostile. Like there are a lot of eye-opening things. But that is a rabbit hole. And when you go back to academia, you do like see their perspective again as well, which is a good thing for your dissident, maybe right-wing, maybe like pro-white arguments, all right? But so it's good for that reason, but it's also the good for the reason that it changes you, because you can see that they actually are talking about some of the things that we're talking about. I'll give you an example. The Indigenous Health course that I took, they're talking about the ills of modernity affecting Indigenous Canadians, right? Think of them as American Indians, you know, they're a really diverse group in their own right. You know, it goes from the Inuit or what some people might still call Eskimo in the north down to the, you know, the more like big civilization, like Aztec or Mayan or I don't want to trip over the terminology here, but there are different groups. And they're talking about how these people were just absolutely crushed by disease, alcohol, and now modernity, right? And all of these social ills, right? These, if you want to look at it from a religious perspective, you know, the lack of their own religion and then the imposition of a colonial or Western or settler. I'm easy on the terminology. I'm not going to get locked into that. But they're saying the same thing with different language that Indigenous European people are saying about how their lives are being affected by, you know, immigration, drugs and alcohol, disease. Like they're saying the same thing. So the amount of common ground that you can reach, just as long as you just don't dig your heels in and decide like, no, you know, I'll stick with the way it was put by, I don't want to grab some, you know, right-wing extremists' names, but I know they can be very, like, you want to be on that team, right? But there's a lot of common ground, and that's expressed in academia, and if you can take that on, we're fighting the same thing, which is a system that is abusive towards various groups that are under them, okay? You know, and yeah. Like, we could talk about, like, elites and, you know, how a rotation of the elites is needed and how they, it just, you know, the
yeah.
You know, yeah.
But let's not get into that just now. We can talk about that another time, but right now I want to keep it focused on this. So there were other aspects of this that I wanted to, well, okay, so we're talking about what the school culture is like, and that for British people, that's the university, what the culture is like. That is a point that I think a lot of people will wonder about. And you've said it is universally leftist, but that you can actually get along within it. Now, that's interesting because, and this might be relevant to age, a lot of young people say that being at the university is a nightmare. Like for us, like dissidents, will say, I'm at university just now. It's hell. I have to keep my mouth shut. I have to pretend to agree with loads of stuff. It's overwhelming. It's suffocating, etc. Would I be right in thinking that it's actually easier to put up with all of that when you're 40 than when you're 20?
Absolutely. Because so
you're have more to keep self-contained your mouth, anyway.
You have to keep your mouth shut at a job.
Yeah.
If you're working at a job. And I've had, I don't want to even get into my work history, but it's not like you can say whatever you want at a job. And like young people might not know this, but, and the other thing is when I say that it's universally leftist, I mean, like if you look at it in totality, okay, but you're going to have right-wing professors, you're going to have professors that don't want to touch things. Like, and I'll give you some examples. I was in an archaeology program, and the first day, the professor, who's like an internationally renowned, highly respected, highly intelligent, frankly, a lovely man, he's talking about Indiana Jones, and he's joking about punching a Nazi. And I'm kind of like, oh, here we go. Like, you know, and this is already, this is a year ago, a year and change ago. And, you know, it's like, yeah, like, you know, we've heard this before. It's kind of like, yeah, you know, it is funny, but it's also tired. And, but when I got into the program itself, okay, while there is maybe some lip service paid to the current zeitgeist, or the zeitgeist as it was maybe 10 years ago or whatever, when you actually get into the substance of the courses, they're teaching you stuff that just objectively accords with our worldview. You know, they're talking about how the Harappan civilization was this civilization that made structures out of cow poop and then disappeared, and they didn't have wars, but they weren't that dynamic. And like, you know, and you're kind of like, well, it's like, there's only so much they can use coded language and cherry pick their examples. But like, especially when you're in a field with like archaeology, you know, you're talking about an inequality of achievement by civilizations or non-civilizations or whatever. And you're kind of feeling like, well, this is like, and so my experience in that course was excellent. I got A's in both classes. I actually said what I wanted in several courses, you know, on final exam, long-term, long essay questions. And I was surprised to get like really good marks back. I was like, oh, you have to not go in there with the mentality of thinking that they're out to get you. But that being said, you have to be a bit of a judge of character, which is also like something that comes with age and maturity and wisdom, right? So I've in my latest course, I actually get the worst marks in my political science courses, because you will run into two factors there, which are careerism. So people that just, and I've had a professor, and it was pretty clear to me, like, this guy should have been like a conservative, but he's like wise enough to be like, look, I got a good thing going here. I make a good wage. I've got a family of my own. I'm not kicking over this apple cart for this punk kid. And he basically kind of told me that at one point when I was trying to get a little, like, I was trying to be a little bit like, you know, like, well, you know, not even that egregious, but you just mentioning a thing like, you know, like, oh, you know, Tony Blair's written his, you know, memoirs, like, interesting memoirs for a labor leader, hey? Or, you know, like, just sort of like touching, and it's just like, no, shut down. And then you will also get the full blown leftist, which I just tangled with. I'm glad that course is over, and that was like intro to political science, and the professor is a member of a left wing political party who is active in ferreting out people. And one thing that I did in that course is there was an online lecture where you could be in a chat, and I did one, and I was like, I can't not out myself as being a dissident. So I was like, I'm not going to participate in any of the chats. I did the first one, and then I just listened to the pre-recorded lectures, wrote the papers, knowing that this person was out to politically get me. And it was also like, I got a B+ in that class. And when I look back at like how I answered some of my essay questions too, it was like, yeah, I can see that she's not agreeing with me because I'm wrong, not because I'm incorrect, but because she's nitpicking things. And oh, and also I should mention that you should be aware that how they will get you is not by saying, obviously, no, you're wrong, your opinions are abhorrent, because you're not going to write like abhorrent opinions, you know. They're going to nitpick you over technicality. So, you know, cross your T's and dot your I's, and they really clobber you over like footnoting and things like that, where, you know, I think I mentioned in an essay, or maybe I posted somewhere, like, I probably should have gotten an A or 100% on a paper. And she pointed out like two grammatical errors, which reduced it to an 80. And I was like, well, like, hell, fair game that I didn't know that the word populism isn't to be spelled with a capital P. But that was like a 10% ding on the paper. And the other one was like, your sentences were a bit long. So she was questioning like the style. And like, I'm good enough at editing. I know that this isn't like a run-on sentence. She just, you know, so and that's what you'll be faced with, is if they want to get you, and they're the kind of person that will get you, they'll ding you over that. So you've got to be pretty dutiful in rereading anything you write, and just, you know, and again, though, if you're on a lowered course load, you'll have the time to do that, right?
Yeah. There are other things about the you said that, well, you used the phrase that she's out to ferret out people. And is there a sense that they want to keep, I mean, obviously it could just be revenge because she might just be have an animus against right-wing people. But is there also a sense that these people are aware of the danger of right-wingers and being in the system and that they want to sort of keep the system pure? Or is that paranoia on my part?
I would say that it's always, you have to be careful to not ascribe bad motivation to people, which they do to us all the time. These people, especially, not to harp on boomers, but the boomers or boomer truth regime kind of mentality, of which there are less and less in the school. They honestly believe what they think, and they think that right-wing extremism is a danger, and probably it is in some sense. And so you've got sort of older people that are cautious about what they, without, and I again, don't ascribe bad motivation to these people. They're doing what they think is right. It's my personal view that in almost any warfighting army in the history of warfare or any conflict, the people aren't there because they're like, we're the bad guys. Like, even a pirate on a pirate ship in, the 16th century or whenever the high, heavy heyday of piracy was, like, was probably like a poor person that was like, oh, I just need to get on this ship and take a few things and then I can get back to Mali. And, like, ascribing bad motivation and like moral evil is probably not the way to go. That being said, the young woke leftist is dangerous because they've absorbed and internalized a lot of the discourse over the last 10 years, 15-ish, since things really got crazy, maybe 2012 or so. These people are dangerous, and they will openly say, and I've heard this like through my partner or whatever, they'll say stuff to their classes like, we are taking over this program. We teach this from a perspective that supports transgenders. And if you are, and they'll even include this in their syllabus, okay? So their syllabus, some of these people will say, if you are threatening or hateful to students in this class, this is just some professors, so don't get freaked out, but they'll have that right in the syllabus as a pretext to bouncing you out. So just be aware of who you're talking to, and be aware that you're probably your most heavily indoctrinated person that's like an opponent might be like maybe a bit younger than five. I'd have to like sort of think about who would have been a certain age, like, entering university, and I'll say like 10 years younger than I am. There's a sweet spot there for people that just lived in like a really politicized culture.
So people, let's say age 25 to 35.
Maybe. Yeah. That's today, where you might find some. Yeah. Yeah. Because the older set are more like Gen X-y, and they were kind of like, the audience I'm talking to probably knows that these people are much more benign. It's a matter of indoctrination, right? And on that note, like the political climate of the university to the eye as a according to like how, what posters up in a university or something like that. Like, yeah, it's going to seem like a left wing nut house. Like, it's just like when you look at the poster board of what posters are you're even allowed to post, that has to go through like a certain group of people. Those people will probably be like either careerists or leftists, and they're not going to take some chance on you putting up a thing that's like, what's that show that everyone refers to? It's like the right wing indoctrination kind of World War II revisionist. The name escapes me right now, but everyone sort of is their go to. Oh, have you seen this? And like they're not gonna put up something there that's gonna be like that's just gonna draw the ire of people. It's all gonna be like there's a rape culture. That's assumed that there's a rape culture in any given university, okay? And I would say that's probably the number one thing you're gonna see around in posters and like at my university you even have to go through like a sexual assault awareness course before they'll even take you as a student, okay? Which, you know, fair enough. And I took the course and actually it had a lot to say that was interesting or true even. So the overall culture is going to see, like, if you're easily put off by that sort of thing, yeah, it's you're going to think, oh, I don't belong here. But I'm saying you do, because when you get into the substance of what's actually there, a lot of the times it's a lot more tolerable than you'd think. And you can do fine. Like, trust, you know, I'm on Millennial. Like, I'm aware of the opinions that people who I like agree with have, and, you know, some that I don't, but yeah, like if I can make it, you can. It's a you problem if you can't, you know, be quiet about a few things and just accept it. Also, like, you have to look at it from like trendism, right? Like, you know, if you were to look at my university, you'd think, oh, so it's like 15% of kids are like transgender. There's a lot of like, you know, transgender presenting students. Not that they've like actually transgender, but, you know, there's a lot of like sort of black nail polish, blue hair, you know, maybe political shirt, you know, maybe a phenotype that rejects body conformity. If I can say it that way. But like, you have to understand, like, this is a trend people are going through. When I first went to university, the trend was to have what we called frosted flakes. These were dudes that would dye their hair with like frosted highlights on blonde hair, which was like kind of like Backstreet Boys sort of stuff. And like, we just like looked down, we were like, home, like, you know, it was just like, wow, these guys, right? And it was like kind of gay coded or whatever. And they were trying to get girls, but to us it was gay coded. And it's like, oh, this is a bad trend. And so you're always going to have trends. So just assume like, yeah, you know, this will change. If I went to university 10 years later, it would be different. So yeah, don't get too lost in thinking like you're being oppressed or something like that.
I've got quick demonstration to lighten the mood.
Oh, thank you. Oh, the Abercrombie. Yeah. So when I to transgress against this trend, actually, my friends and I, when we were going back to university, and this was like 2000, I don't know, 2002 to 2004 to 2005 or 2006. I think I graduated in 2007, actually. to transgress against this, we showed that we were implacable, like, you know, men, by wearing what we called the uniform, which was blue jeans and a white t-shirt. So we looked like the Navy sailors from the American movies, which were popular at the time, like Pearl Harbor and stuff like this, right? So we would try to look like, I'm not taking on a trend. Blue jeans, white t-shirt, maybe some Adidas three-stripe shoes or something like that. And that was kind of like our rejection of this like attention seeking, which
I can remember that stuff being in that kind of style. Okay, there are a couple of questions more. You made a point to me, I don't know when we were talking about this, a month or so ago, and you said that the system can't allow the universities to fail. I think. Do you remember saying that?
Yeah. I could go on this for hours, but so one of the so if you look at society, okay, in most of Western society, things are getting tighter. They're less generous. I mean, from food prices to costs, okay, incurred costs for things that you used to take for granted, your home heating, it's becoming less generous. University, they can't make it less generous for a variety of structural reasons now. One is that probably first and foremost, university is still where the elites come from. It is a primary method of socializing people into the current politically accepted regime within the Overton window, whatever. Okay. So they're not going to shut down their own version of the church. And university really is it's a seminary for young people who are the elites and whatnot. So they're obviously it's going to be one of the last things that they are like budget cuts, you know, or to diminish its prestige. Okay. So it's still a place that's has pretty high regard other than by like kind of us, ironically, but it has high social regard. It's well subsidized. It has generous programs. Importantly, it's a main source of corporate sponsorship. So there's not a university in the world that doesn't have several monuments to like, you know, Chevron, Bill and Melinda Gates, you know, like whatever, like these giant plaque boards. A lot of your local businesses, when they want to get a high profile and a tax break by making a big donation, they'll donate to the university. It's just a good place for largesse to go to. And so it doesn't feel like cheap and stingy, you know, like in almost any other element of society. Now it feels like you're getting the screws turned on you. University still feels generous. The programs are still good. The tuition amounts, or whatever. Often, like in researching this, you know, a lot of loans, a lot of the financing that they'll give you is indexed to inflation or the, you know, in Canada, we have the CPI, the consumer price index or whatever. And, you know, they want people to go into this. And on that note too, they also are now dependent on foreign students. And this is one thing where I found it's different between countries, quite different. Canada has gone the route of charging non-Canadian citizens, I think accepting the Commonwealth, triple tuition. So this is a common complaint for like Chinese students attending university in Canada. They're charged triple. Indian students too, which maybe is why you see less Indian students than Chinese students. It's a wealthier country. Parents of Chinese students can afford to pay triple tuition for their students, for their children in school. So they're subsidizing your tuition. So that's a thing that university is also kind of addicted to, is at least in Canada. Now there's other countries that do this a bit differently. Germany's gone a different route, which is to, I think, make, and I'd have to research this, so don't take this to the bank, but I think that they've made a lot of their universities free with the thinking that, like, look, we have lots of universities and, you know, like it's still prestige to go to get educated in Germany. And they'll get their monetary, they'll get what the state wants from the living costs. And I referred to this way earlier. Like, yeah, you can make the tuition, which is normally, I don't know, like say $2,500, $3,500 a semester Canadian. Yeah, that's where you can ding the students, or you can make that free and like your community and country will get them with rents and food costs and all these other costs, right? And that's really where your university cost goes to. So university is too big to fail. It's too prestige to fail. It's too plugged in. And so it's a place where in an economic depression or something like we're, I think, looking at, it's a place that's going to be okay till we get in and pass out. So if you're stressed out now and you're grinding away and you're a person that thinks that it might be like a lifestyle and a challenge that might suit you, this might be a good time to get in.
Yeah, it sounds like it might be, and there was one other point that I wanted you to raise. I mean, just to underline, because some people will be asking this question. The dissidents are people, especially on our side, who feel that the system is against them and hates them. So, if that is the case, then why shouldn't we benefit from it? especially in this way, because this is a way that it's not just financial benefit, it's also educational. You're also learning. So in other words, it's using the system to our own advantage rather than just allow it to sap us for our time and energy.
Yeah, exactly. And just, you know, to be clear, like, you know, I have my opinions and they could generally be called sort of right-wing conservative, something like that. But I invite anyone to come in, like, the, you know, especially like more thoughtful middle-aged people with families. I'm not hating against someone that's critiquing the elites from the left. This is kind of like an academic agent thing, or Dr. Parvini, like, don't get too attached to the right wing, so-called, if what you're criticizing is the system. And the system's not expressly left or right wing. They'll kind of grab off the shelf solutions, political. Oh, look, no, we're doing this now, right? To justify, you know, basically the theft and abuse that they're inflicting on people. So yeah. So for starters, yes, if you're a different inclination than right wing, absolutely, you know, get in there, return to academia. And sorry, could we just go back to what you were saying?
Why shouldn't we
use
the system to our own advantage?
So I'll put it this way. My university doesn't make a penny off me. I'm sure I cost them money. Sorry, but the university system isn't dependent so much on tuitions. They have, it depends what institution, but they have huge multi-million or billion-dollar bursaries that are invested. They get money from the state. They have all kinds of financing. So don't think that you, like, you know, this, like, this, again, the last doughboy over the top. It doesn't need to be you. Like, you know, don't feel, and yeah. Good.
There was one other point that I've just remembered. Didn't you say that the foreign students actually pay more than the native students, the Canadian students? And so what that means is that they're actually subsidizing you.
Correct. Yeah. In Canada, and like, countries are different. I know that. And that's kind of like, you know, like a rare W for diversity, I would say, you know, and so, yeah. And this kind of reminds me of an old economic argument about GDP. Do you remember, as being slightly older? Remember how everything was about bloody GDP? And you felt like you were less of a man if you weren't paying your taxes, because we just need to turn these, we need the black line to go up. Well, how did, like, what the heck happened to that? That's not even, nobody talks about, the only time GDP is mentioned is when it's in terms of, like, the Russians' GDP is, we're going to, their GDP, ooh, it's on the rocks. Nobody cares about this. We know, like, those of us that know that they just print money, and that money is like an abstraction, and it's kind of like a collective delusion that we're passing. You could compare it to like religion, politics. These are like kind of collective delusions that we choose to believe in, right? If you think like that your life is less important than GDP, you should rethink things. Like, do what's successful. Do what's going to get you a family. Do what's going to make you happy. Do what's going to make your day-to-day a bit easier. So yeah, absolutely. Like, don't worry about, you know, bankrupting the system. You individual person, to me anyways, you're more important than the system. The system's shot. Okay. I don't know what the new system, the new regime, the new political solution or whatever is going to be, but, like, you know, it's not going to be through your personal suffering.
Yeah. No. So, to sum up, well, let's put it in very brief terms. Like, for the last two. Well, actually, no. We'll do that. We'll do that later, because there are a couple of super chats that I should put to you. Three of them. So the Wanderer asks, "What are your thoughts?" Sorry. These are both. That was from the previous one. Okay, Stephen says that he's a recent STEM grad. 100% are a social science, political science thing, not a page-long theorem proof thing. Average class is 3 credit hours. Expectation is the student will study 3 hours per credit hour. So that'd be 9 hours. And while I'm against tradey absolutism, remember that Yanks, Americans, won't get many goodies, as in Canada. Okay, I'm not quite sure what point he's making. Recent study had 100% sort of... Go on.
Yeah, I can pick up on that. So this is a man with like a really masculine perspective on things that thinks that he's smart and can just like sort of crash through it and do it. And he's in the science program. You know, that's like, I think maybe mentioned engineering. I went to school with engineering students while I was doing my first degree in history. And one guy in particular, a friend of mine, and he was he let me know how difficult these programs are. And basically, like, they're trying to fail you out of an engineering program. The point of an engineering program is to weed people out. That's different than like an arts program where it's trying to let people through, but kind of skim some people off the top to join an elite or something like that. So he's not wrong. And as far as his breakdown of numbers goes, yeah, probably. And, this is like kind of like a typical, he's got an aggressive attitude towards this. And my point isn't, you know, to talk about the relative strengths of programs, but more to be like, look, if this suits your lifestyle or where you are in life, that lifestyle word's kind of a bit tainted. Consider it. I don't know if I answered that all the way, but yeah.
Okay. And he also said, on a different note, I find Socrates' rhetoric to be inspirational. I went through it recently, and politics aside, the students and faculty in the math programming departments were awesome, helpful people. I learned math, coding, stats, data analysis. Worth it. So there you go. That's somebody who he actually agrees with you. And I think he was... taking issue with one detail of what you've said, but in general he's backing you up on this is I don't know how old he is. I think he's about 30. This is a viable and worthwhile path to choose, at least for a few years. I mean, this doesn't need to be the rest of your life, obviously.
I'll pick up on that too. Like if you're like, so there's different kind of ways you can approach this. Is kind of like I'm not saying do it exactly like I did or whatever. I'm saying like, if this works for you at where you are in your life, try it out. Because like, let's say you try it and you go to university for a year and you rack up $10,000 in student loan debt. That's not even the price of like a used car in Canada anymore. This is where I'm saying like, there are things going on where you need to look at it sort of holistically and be like, so like, you know, I kind of like took a year off my life. I learned a lot. I would say for starters, and importantly, there's absolutely merit to the university programs. And like, yeah, this is, they're still mostly great. They're, you know, it's worth knowing this stuff. Even if you're talking about Shakespeare or chemistry or like whatever, like that's where you go to do it. Right. I'm not to disparage people that do it on their own, and like the right wing or the dissidents, we're loaded with people that have just done it on their own. So you can absolutely do that, but there's a great benefit to maybe testing it against a university system for a year. And also, this is really important. Don't get over your head in debt. Okay. So this is also where being a mature student, you know, like what you can kind of handle and what you can't. Okay. So don't like go for it and wind up like, you know, $80,000 in debt and whatever. And on that note, like there are going to be a lot of financial institutions that are trying to give you student loans. I would eschew all of them other than your federal, because a private bank or something like that, they're going to pursue you hard for your debt. They're also going to lobby the government to make it easier for debt collection and whatever. This should be kind of obvious to people that are a little more older, savvy, wiser or whatever. I didn't know this. When I was young, I got a good chunk of my loans from a bank and had to pay the bank back. Wouldn't do that again. I just didn't know. Nobody told me. This is me telling you. Definitely go through your governments. And I know we're a little tight for time, but also there's the bigger picture of the student loan debt in like the West is just a crazy number that will never be paid back. You could take, don't take it from me. These like there's big financial institutions, sort of JP Morgan, or the big investment houses or whatever. They've looked at this debt, which in the States, I think is about $2 trillion now. So that's $2,000 billion of student loan debt. They've looked at this and said, we're never getting this back. If you look at certain repayment rates, so their only route is to do write-offs, and they are writing off debt, and maybe close to a conclusion, depending on how late you want to go. My partner's debt was written off. Like she made payments on it and she paid some portion of it, but eventually in Canada, they just write it off for like 10 years. They'll write it off. In the States, they have a different way because they're kind of a little more, they have a different set of values. So who they write off debt for in the States is military veterans, disabled people, and other groups, which probably do deserve to have their debt written off. And it's happening. And Joe Biden, when he got in, and he's contemptible, obviously, but he did want to write off $400 billion of debt, which would have been like about a third or a quarter of the overall U.S. debt. And he got blocked by, you know, I'll say Trump, but it's not Trump. It's, you know, he got blocked by the financial institutions. They said, no, you can't write this down. But what's happening is they're looking at, like, if the States is $20 trillion in debt and $2 trillion of that is student loan debt, and it's really like a social issue that's hampering internal development of educating their own people, and it's holding people back, and it's hated, and it makes people vote certain ways or whatever, they're going to write that down. They're not going to tell you about it, okay? But they're going to quietly write down student loan debt. So your chances of actually having to pay off your full debt, and like credit to you if your education got you, a paycheck that you were able to pay, like, hey, I'm proud of you. If you wrote off a $50,000 debt for med school or engineering or $100,000, like, what, like, that's great. You're a person that's great for this country, you know, thank you. But if you entered an economy where you thought that your Bachelor of Art would, you know, be more valuable to you than it was, don't beat yourself up. That's not really a you problem. That's kind of a system problem, especially if you've tried and you entered. Like when I graduated in 2007, so I entered 2008, a big financial collapse. I had to relocate to like the far north of Canada to get a job, okay, from like a nice southern place, go way up there to try to survive because there was just no hope. So do what's right for you. By doing what's right for you, you're going to be doing right by your country, okay? The country doesn't actually want, you know, some people say like they want us wage slaves. That's true to some extent. They definitely want you in debt, for sure. But they don't want you so in debt that you're just like, in tatters and you're really railing against the system and you become like a communist or something, right? So, yeah.
Yeah. All right, excellent. Stephen made one more super chat. I wasn't shitting on the arts or humanities. I was just saying don't get despondent if you don't get perfect grades on certain subjects. Thank you for your insights, Soccer City. I didn't mean to be insulting.
So that's not at all. I've got thick skin, man. I've spent decades in the trades. You could have come at me a lot longer than that.
All right. So let's end by summarizing this very quickly. What is it that you're suggesting people might consider doing?
So my suggestion is to, if you are suffering now and you can't put food on the table for your kids and you don't know what to do, you should consider this right away. Okay. You're better off to incur some debt that you may or may not have to pay back. And on the, it's not like they demand like an arm and a leg. Like most or all systems of repayment that I've looked into, they look at a certain income level. So like if you're making over, say, $40,000-$50,000 a year, then they want like 7% of your income to be paid back. You can do that, okay, as long as you didn't just dig yourself deep in. It's not even going to affect you. There might even be tax stuff around that where you can write off the taxes to the debt. You'd be like, I don't know. You get tuition credits too in Canada. I think in other countries too, they're nice to you on the taxes if you have debt. So,
all right. So this is something that is lots of people might consider doing because
I just want to touch on the compassion. And people are suffering right now. We're looking at war and depression and all these other places. And that's my essay on Substack, writing out the storm in the schoolhouse. Okay. And this was just like, basically, if you're suffering and if you want to get through an economic depression or something, this is a good place to be. It's a positive place. Okay. So from a compassionate point of view, okay. Yeah. Do go into debt to give yourself like a relief. Your perspective on the world is going to really improve if you just can get out of the rat race a little bit. Also, this is the place where you can meet friends, you can socialize, you can study the great philosophers. Like, I took philosophy, I studied Plato, you know. It's rewarding, it's fulfilling. So for personal reasons, if you're like frustrated and you're like, I don't know where to go, I'm thinking about getting a job at like McDonald's or something. Yeah, don't do that. I'm not saying don't get a job, but if you're just about to take on something that's going to make your life miserable and you have the ability to go and focus in school, do that. At least try it. So as a note of like compassion, Merry Christmas, everyone, by the way. Consider these options. And one thing is that you won't know how good it is till you try it, because they don't really let you know how much your loan and tuition and all these amounts will be. It's only when you get it and you kind of are into it, you're like, oh, actually, this is kind of nice. And then you're like, yeah, I think my comfort level on this is to do it for so long. You can also leave a degree and come back like within a certain window too. If you want to go work and pay your debt down to zero, that's an option. I guess my final thing would be, this is a big option set. Okay. Guys got to have options. So this is a big option that's still on the table. Go to university, and you can also, you know, promulgate your worldview, right? You're going to learn things where you'll be able to actually change the world, not just in like actually achieving something. You know, you might not be like the deputy minister of culture or something, but you'll be online, you'll be shit posting online or whatever, and you'll be able to back it up more. These things, like, we win by increments, right? So if you can persuade other people on that note, I'm talking to a friend of mine that is like, I wouldn't say he's like a spiritual leftist. He's like a really compassionate person. He's much more compassionate than I am, but he's like a really good guy. I grew up with this guy from a young age. He's like a great guy. And I'm talking with him about it. And we're reaching common ground, you know. We can, and he's like, you know, we're able to discuss things. So you are able to actually change the culture instead of thinking that you can change it from a high level, which you can do from university, but you can also do it from a low level by getting educated. You know who's a great guy about this? Carl Benjamin, Sargon of Akkad. This guy's like out there in the discourse, even if he wasn't, you know, as famous as he is. He's out there changing people's minds and having discussions in their language or a mutual discourse. Okay. Without, you know, and he reins it in all the time. And like, he's changed his perspective, but his perspective has changed people as well. He's a great example of someone that I just think kind of embodies the spirit of discourse, you know?
All right. Let's end it there. I think this is something people should consider. Soka City, thank you for presenting it to people as an option set. And I hope that some people do consider it. All right. I'll be back tomorrow. Let me just see what's happening tomorrow. I'm pretty sure it's Morgoth and probably the Christmas card stream. It depends. They need to be posted to me. Hopefully they will arrive in time. If not, then I'll do it on Christmas Day. Okay. Soka City, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025.
Thank you. A lot of fun. Thank you.
Okay.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? The Millennial NFT is a unique animated vector graphic available for just one lucky owner. The auction closes on the 30th. Make your bid today. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.